Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll start with CNN's John King and ask if the plea of a murdered student's father will cause what he called craven, irresponsible politicians to do anything about guns. Then Jared Remy pleads guilty to first-degree murder, just days after a young man goes on a rampage in California. We'll discuss the real war on women. Then Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane on the anatomy of a commencement speech with focus on what she considers the best of the best.
We'll return to the case of Jared Remy and ask you whether the sins of the son should be visited on the father, in this case, Red Sox broadcaster Jerry Remy. And then Ethan Gilsdorf joins us on Beowulf and Legos. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Rowdy is back. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Seems like a lifetime, doesn't it? So, hi there, Marjorie. Fresh from a surprise visit with troops in Afghanistan, Barack Obama acknowledges the need to confront the scandal at the nation's veterans' hospitals, not to mention an unfortunate slip-up while in Afghanistan. And will the latest mass shooting at UC Santa Barbara campus get us any closer to gun reform in D.C.? Joining us on the line to take on these and other national headlines is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. John, as you know, also hosts Inside Politics on Sunday mornings. Hey there, John.
Happy Tuesday.
And to you.
Happy Tuesday to you. We're not going to start out, though, very happily, John. I want to start by playing some sound from Richard Martinez. He's the father of the young man, Chris Martinez, who was the last victim in this rampage. Jim just referred to at UC Santa Barbara, of that young man, Elliot Rogers. Let's hear from the dad.
Chris died because of craven, irresponsible politicians and the NRA. They talk about gun rights. What about Chris's right to live? When will this insanity stop?
So, you know, we went through Newtown, and that didn't make a difference in terms of gun laws or the NRA, John King. And I don't know, this dad, when you see him and you hear him, your heart just breaks. It's so impassioned, and he just calls the NRA right out and politicians as well. Does this matter, or is this gone tomorrow?
I don't know that it's gone tomorrow, and you have to respect and listen to the emotions of any parent when they suffer such a loss. The issue is the math of Washington. We talked about this. You mentioned Newtown. We could go back as far as Columbine, really, and shooting since, and not much is done. There was an attempt, remember, we thought it might even make it. It got very close to the finish line. Joe Manchin, the Democratic Senator of West Virginia, Pat Toomey, the Republican of Pennsylvania, talked about expanded background checks. It was a pretty modest bill. And it collapsed and didn't get there at the end. There is some talk now of trying to do something in the short term solely addressed to the mental health issue, at least some increased funding for mental health, and maybe some conversation about, and this gets hard. It's a hard policy issue because of the privacy concerns, but, you know, something to encourage and to allow mental health professionals to do more, to step forward when they worry about somebody without being sued or being, you know, blamed for violating patient privacy. It's a very difficult issue. That requires a lot of thought, and people a lot smarter than I am, people with clinical experience. There's some thought that Congress could have a discussion solely focused on the mental health aspect in the wake of Santa Barbara, but I can't tell you I'm terribly optimistic even about that. The Republican House has shown no appetite for anything that has to do with gun control, and there are a handful of key Senate Democrats, not just Republicans, there are a handful of key Senate Democrats in races this year who are the reason that the background check thing collapsed last time. So we'll see what happens out of this conversation, and we'll see if the president wants to step forward. Again, if they narrowly tailored it to mental health, they might be able to do something. But what happens when an issue like this comes up is then everybody has their own pet cause, and they try to attach it, and that's when, you know, things go off the rails.
And I assume the opponents of doing anything would say, hey, listen, California has tighter laws about mental health issues than the federal law. The federal law is something about if you're involuntarily committed to a psychiatric treatment facility, California has much tighter laws. So the reality here, as you say, is that this is going to be – the outcome is going to be the same. There's no – when you say we'll see what the discussion leads to, John, it's likely that there's not even a discussion. Is that not fair?
I'm afraid there might not be much of a discussion. That's true. And look, I think that when you have a legislature, part of your job is to just discuss things. You don't necessarily have to legislate all the time. You could just have hearings. You could talk about things. You could bring people in. Is there anything else we can do? And I think you raised an important point because, you know, look, I'm not defending the NRA, but the NRA would say, if you're criticizing them right now, California has much more stringent gun laws. Other people would say, look, the parents and others raised alarms about this kid, and the deputies went to see this kid, and they didn't find any reasons, they didn't find grounds to commit him or to take him into custody in some way. So in a way, and I'm having a hard time speaking these words as a parent and as a journalist, but in a way, there are people say, you know, the system worked in the sense that there was a mental health professional who raised his or her hand. There were parents raising his or her hand. There was an outreach to this kid to double-check him, and he still got through the cracks. And, you know, the psychiatrist can tell you they plan these things, and they know this is coming, and they have their stories all planned. And, again, that's beyond my pay grade. There are some people who would just tell you you can't legislate everything, and that may well be true. I would just like to see thoughtful people have a conversation about this once they have all the information and say, is there anything? Do we find a lapse in the system, a crack in the system, a hole in the system anywhere that we might be able to do anything about it? And if the answer is no, fine. The answer is no, but why not have the conversation?
You know, we just got an email from Ron Odom, who lost his son Stephen at age 13 when Stephen was walking home from a basketball game here in Boston. And Ron said about a father's grief, referring to Mr. Martinez, "I know all too well what that father is going through. When will it end? Something has to be done." Thank you for that email, Ron. And John King, when you talked about the deputies going to this young man's apartment, one of the chilling details was that he had an arsenal in there, and the kid was apparently
legal,
thinking that, oh, if they come into my room, it's curtains and drapes, it's all over, they're going to find all these guns. And they didn't. You can't really blame the cops for that, but that is one of the terrible, heart-rending details in the story, that he had an arsenal in his bedroom.
And that's to me should be part of the conversation. Number one, my understanding is, he, you know, the background checks and everything else, he would have passed. But number two, should it only be law enforcement going on these checks, or should they have a mental health professional with them? Again, way above my pay grade. But the deputies, I mean, how do you think those deputies feel right now?
Yeah.
But they were doing their job, and they think they did their job, and they came back and said they had no grounds. Everybody can criticize them in hindsight, but again, you know, their job is law enforcement.
Hey, John,
not mental health.
John, one last thing on this. The major theme of this second term for the president, and I'm paraphrasing, is if Congress won't do it, I will. Meaning he'll do as much by executive order as he possibly can, for example, like when he raised the minimum wage for the employees of federal contractors several months ago, because obviously he can't raise the federal minimum wage. Does he have any executive power vis-a-vis mental health issues, or is that purely a province of legislation in Congress?
I would assume there's a modest amount of money he could move around within accounts, you know, take from one account and move it somewhere else if he wanted to. Let me throw out another suggestion for you. And again, something I just don't think happens enough. And I'm not criticizing this president. I'm criticizing the system, and it goes back for a long time. Why not call the governors together and the mayors and some police chiefs together and some mental health professionals? And why not set up a series of regional town halls and just go around again and have this conversation and learn from each other and put Michael Bloomberg in a room with some NRA guys? Put a pro-gun sheriff in the room with some of these parents and just let them have a conversation. Go in with the stipulation. Maybe kick the cameras out. Maybe that's the way to do it. I hate to say that because I'm a First Amendment guy, but maybe just go in with the stipulation. We're going to talk. And if tempers get raised, we're going to take a time out. We're not going to let them get to the boiling point. We're going to see if we can learn from each other. What would be the harm in that?
Well, also, do you remember very early, I hadn't thought about this in ages. Do you remember very early on that incredibly strange bipartisan gathering at the White House on health? Was it not on health care the president called just months into his presidency, where I remember John McCain popping up and speaking? It was just this strange, but in some ways wonderful and unusual kind of gathering.
Well, if you understand where the other person is coming from, even if you completely disagree with them, you can respect their argument more. If you hear a little bit more about, you know, why they're a fan of this or why they think this policy doesn't work. And if you have respect for somebody's position, then it's easy to continue the conversation. And again, maybe find, if there's 100 things you disagree on, maybe find the one or two that you do agree on. But you have to have the conversation to get to that point, and that doesn't exist in our policy.
You know, one last thing before we move off this topic. Mr. Martinez was saying how you never expect this to happen until it happens to your child, and you're just shell-shocked, obviously. But I was covering an event yesterday in Roxbury at John Quincy Street and Blue Hill Avenue. There's a park there dedicated to a little kid, Jermaine Goffigan, who at the time was the youngest murder victim in Boston. Now we have a toddler who was killed in Mattapan.
How old was he, like 10 or something? How old
nine. Was he? Nine. He was 9 years yeah. old. He was 9 years old. And anyway, I was talking to his mother, who was saying she never expected 20 years later, Jermaine Goffigan died in 1994, 20 years later, to be still fighting the same battle. And she was there with her niece. So this woman had lost her son at 9 years old. Her niece lost the father of her first child. Then she became involved with a second man. She lost the father of her second child. She lost her cousin. Now she's engaged to a man who lost his own 15-year-old son when the 15-year-old son was waiting, eating a honey bun, waiting for a school bus at 7 o'clock in the morning. So you have these families with this whole web of violence. And that's not including the friends and that they know who have also been shot. So it's like it's an aberration out at UC Santa Barbara, but it is an everyday cousin-brother thing in the inner cities of America. And we just and the people there will tell you, as they told me yesterday, it's the guns, the guns, the guns. Let them use knives. You know, it would be harder to kill, but the guns are everywhere. It's just devastating.
Well, it is. And again, the way you put it, it's true. When you see the numbers out of Chicago, sometimes they're numbing. A lot of people just shrug and say, oh, yeah, that's, you know, the summer in Chicago. But if you get to that point, you really need to go, you know, bang your head up a wall and shake yourself out of that complacency or that, oh, yeah, well, whatever. It happens. But again, it's the way a lot of these families feel. They think nobody's there to help them anymore. They think everybody's just sort of assumed it's part of the equation. And again, you know, there's community responsibility, there's parental responsibility, there's school responsibility, there's, you know, do you have to rejigger the police department? Are there gun law debates to be had? All excellent questions, but they're not being discussed in a comprehensive way almost anywhere in the country.
Let's speaking of Chicago, where some would argue there's more violence in certain neighborhoods than there even is in Afghanistan. The president makes a surprise visit to Afghanistan, but the story is not the president going there for Memorial Day to thank the troops and say what support we have. The story is about this inadvertent release of the name of the CIA's chief of station in Afghanistan. John, could you tell the story and say what the significance of this inadvertent release is?
Well, I don't know the real significance, and I don't think we will for some time because so much of this is classified. But what happened was Scott Wilson, a perfectly good, a great reporter for the Washington Post, was there in the pool, and he went into the press staff and said, can we get a list of the people who are briefing the president? And the press aide went to a military person who gave them this list. It had the station chief's name on it, identified with his name, and then, comma, station chief. And the military person gave it to the press aide. The press aide gave it to the reporters. Scott Wilson distributed it to his colleagues, and they put it out on the pool list that the White House puts out to reporters. And then he looked down and realized, read it again and said, holy, you know what, we can't, whoa. And went back and said, is this supposed to be here? And the press aide said, well, the military gave it to me. It must be okay. And then she went back up the chain and they were told, oh, no, we got a problem here. So it started with the military in Afghanistan. It went through a White House aide. They both should have caught it. It's their job. It happens. People make mistakes. This is a big mistake. So what sensitive, you know, we're in the middle of the president's announcing later today this drawdown of troops. We're trying to negotiate this status of force agreement with Karzai's successor, whoever that is. There are all sorts of Taliban calculations and Al-Qaeda calculations and, you know, extremist tracking going on in Afghanistan and the Pakistan border and the like. What was this guy working on at the time? What sensitive people was he maybe trying to bring in or negotiate with? What other projects was he working with? How much are they endangered? I have no idea, and I don't think that we will know for probably months or years. Then there's his personal career. He's been outed. So can he go, if he's the station chief in Afghanistan, that tells me he's a damn good operative, because that's one of the most sensitive jobs in the world. I suspect now that he can't do that job anywhere. So he's coming back to headquarters or doing something else. I'm that last step is a speculation on my part, but I find it really hard to think that he can somehow do his job again at the level he's doing it. And the other thing we don't know is, you know, I assume his direct family knows what he does for a living, but maybe his neighbors don't, or maybe a lot of people around him don't. And what happens in that dynamic?
Yeah.
So this is the ripple effect of this is something we'll be dealing with for a month, if not longer.
You know, John, I was looking to see if I could find this guy's name anywhere. I couldn't find it. Does that mean no one reported it, or what?
It means it got scrubbed very quickly. There are ways to find it in some email chains and some postings. And this is an example of, you know, look, people sometimes think we're in cahoots with the White House. Sometimes the White House thinks we're totally at war with them. You know, there are times when the news media has to exercise judgment and responsibility, and I think we do a pretty good job of it. I think we do an excellent job of it when it comes to things like this. And it was one of the reporters who realized, whoa, what's this guy's name doing on this piece of paper? We don't do this. And he's the one who ran it back up the chain to them. There are times on our White House trips when we've had major security lapses that have been pointed out by reporters quietly. And so, you know, you're there to cover the president, and you have to be, it's an adversarial role sometimes, but we're not interested in, you know, destroying the careers of a CIA officer, nor are we interested in undermining U.S. intelligence. And in this case, as soon as the journalist, who's a damn good one, realized what was up, you know, he ran it up the flagpole until it got fixed. And then they quickly told the other reporters, you know, to the degree you can, pull it back as fast as you can.
Yeah, I want to talk about fighting men and women, not in Afghanistan, but home, and what the update is in the VA since we spoke to you last week, John. But before we move to that, how can this possibly happen? I mean, it's one thing, as you describe it, if, you know, if one person inadvertently left a name like this on a list, but my understanding is went from the military to the White House people, then to the I mean, the assumption is it went through a number of how could this possibly have been on a final list that went out to whatever it is, these 6,000 journalists? How's that happen?
I don't personally know the two key people, the military person and then the White House person involved. I know the White House person, I've been told who it is, but I don't know her personally. Not a ton of experience, but not brand new to the job either. But was handed a list by somebody in the military who said, here's a good list. And, you know, so why are you, you know, the rule should be, in a sensitive situation, stop, take a breath, scrub everything 3 or 4 times. This was sort of, it seems like it was sort of done ad hoc, and they didn't realize their mistake at the time. Look, human beings are human. I'm sure nobody did it on purpose, but there were a couple of firewalls where it should have been caught.
So John King from CNN, we are, of course, just getting over Memorial Day weekend, many memorials all around the country for our veterans of Afghanistan, Iraq, and all our other wars. What's the update on the Veterans Administration post-Memorial Day?
There's sort of two tracks. One is there's a political track, which is criticism of the White House and criticism of Veterans Affairs Secretary Shinseki. You have this up close. Scott Brown campaigning in New Hampshire saying, you know, he's one of the first to say he should resign. A handful of Democrats in big races have said that. Not a ton of Democrats who already have elected jobs in the Senate and the House have said that. The White House has been able to keep, and the leadership has been able to keep a handle on that. And give Shinseki some time. You heard the president last week. He sent him essentially halfway down the plank and said, wait there until we get the final report. It was not exactly an overwhelming endorsement. So I hope this proceeds on two tracks. And the first one is the political track, which is it's inevitable. It is a failure of leadership. This is something the White House may not have known the specifics of these waiting lists, but the president knew back in 2008, and the Bush administration warned them in the transition memos that this was a mess, that things were out of control, and that the VA needed urgent attention, and the president promised to give it. If you were giving it urgent attention every day, I think you would have learned about these secret lists from someplace other than CNN. So I do think the management questions and the if it's the bureaucracy, if the bureaucracy is lying to Washington and the bureaucracy is not responding to Washington, well, then the bureaucracy has to be blown up. So there's a political argument there. And the policy track is the president's deputy chief of staff is going around to these facilities, and they're trying to find a way to make sure that it stops. Make sure that if I'm going to use the Phoenix example, you've got 20 guys who need urgent care and you can't get them in because you're backlogged and you don't have the resources, that you get them to a private hospital. That if you need to be, you fly in doctors from another veterans facility. So to break that part of it. And to me, that's by far the most important track of it. Now that you've found these mistakes that are probably crimes, can you deal with that first and get the care on a much better track? And then deal with the political ramifications. So, you know, no one's going anywhere. We can assign political blame anytime we want. So I hope that's the way it happens. And I do think you've seen, even there's been a lot of criticism of the White House, there's been lawmakers in both parties who are involved in these issues trying to change the rules so that you can fire some of these people. Apparently the Secretary of Veterans Affairs doesn't have the authority to fire some of his own people. That's kind of nuts, in my view. If you're the boss, you should be the boss. People deserve due process, don't get me wrong, but if you're the boss, you should be able to pull the triggers of authority. And so they're working on that legislation even as they figure out, was the administration asleep at the switch? Or was it more likely, in my view, just numbed by the bureaucracy? You go through this for years, you're never getting good answers, and you just stop making it a priority because you get numbed by it.
Hey, John, you know, you have never been on our Friday news quiz, which is an atrocity in and of itself. But
what are you talking about? It's terrific.
He should be on our Friday news quiz.
Well, I thought you were talking quiz. The news quiz wasn't a trial.
No, I love the news quiz. But, you know, John, since I missed it on Fridays on vacation, I'm going to ask you a quiz question. Sure, Jim, go right ahead. What do Karl Rove and the left wing of the Democratic Party have in common? You have 10 seconds, John King.
They both think that Hillary Clinton is too old, too stale, not new enough.
Ding, 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 ding. So this unholy alliance, I understand the Karl Rove thing. I was actually watching you this morning at 7:30 talking about the old and stale comment from Karl Rove, who obviously was a key strategist for George W. Bush. And obviously that comes on the heels of the statement he is now trying to back out of about a traumatic brain injury for Hillary Clinton. Is this a story that journalists like to create about how the left doesn't think that Hillary Clinton is left enough, or is that a real thing?
No, it's real, but it's not. I mean, it's. I think they're coming from different places. When you try to make an unholy alliance between Karl Rove and I would say, you know, not Elizabeth Warren directly, but friends of Elizabeth Warren, mm-hmm. they might take objection. They might, you know, I don't know, what kind of car do you drive, Jim? Check the tires when you go outside. Look. You know, they have suspicions about her. They think that, you know, if they go back to her husband's presidency, when you had Bob Rubin as the Treasury Secretary, now exactly a populist. He's a Wall Street guy. Now, the Clinton people argue, you know, we created 20 million jobs. That helped everybody, didn't it? Not the best relationships with the labor unions all the time. They think that she's, you know, because she was a senator from New York and comes from the economic lineage of her husband's administration, she's a little bit too nice to the people on Wall Street that, you know, that the Elizabeth Warren wing of the party thinks should be, you know, flogged a little bit. And there are a couple other issues. She voted for the Iraq War. That's still there. You know, there are still people who are going to say, aha. Yes, there are some differences. Now, Karl Rove is trying to take her down in part, I think, because Republicans think that she might win. And they don't see anyone else on the Democratic side right now who is ready to be president of the United States, who has shown the growth, the arc of growth necessary to go from pretty much nobody on the national scale to president of the United States. It can be done. Our current president is proof. It can be done on a short arc. However, that's where Karl Rove's coming from. They're trying to convince Hillary Clinton, you don't want to do this. It's just going to be so bruising and so horrible. Enjoy your life. Don't run. The left will deal with it if they have to. And trust me, they think, you know, they could do a lot worse than Hillary Clinton. But sure. I mean, one of the challenges on the left right now is, can you find anybody credible to run against her? Even thinking you're probably not going to win, but you just want to have the debates to raise these issues that I'm talking about and make her answer these issues and hopefully make her step your way a little bit on some of the policy prescriptions. But at the moment, you know, who is that?
Well, is that for Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders? I don't think anybody thinks he's about to be the nominee of the Democratic Party, but does he fill that role if Elizabeth Warren does not?
Well, he would be a fun debater. I mean, he's an independent. I guess he would have to register as a Democrat. I don't know. Is that a legal requirement? Could
he
be a Democrat to run for
the
Democratic
nomination? Yeah,
he's a former socialist. Look, Bernie Sanders is a really bright guy. Whether you agree or disagree with his politics, I always make this joke, you know, I'm old. So I go back to the 1992 primaries when it came down to just Bill Clinton and Jerry Brown. And I wish Jerry Brown would run because he gave Bill Clinton fit. And you know what? He's a smart policy guy, but he's also just one of these, like, as a boxer, you think, I'm bigger than him, I'm stronger than him. Then why does he keep hitting me? You know,
how does he keep
planting these punches? You know? There was a time in Michigan where I thought Bill Clinton was literally going to come to blows with Jerry Brown when Jerry Brown criticized Hillary and her law practice. And Clinton turned to him and said, you need my wife out of this.
Good, John.
That was quite fine, John King.
You are a better campaigner. I think both Hillary and Obama would tell you this. And Mitt Romney would tell you this, although he got pushed too far right. You're a better campaigner when you get involved in these debates. And that is a legitimate worry. Deval Patrick just raised this recently. That's a legitimate worry that if she doesn't get a serious primary challenge, she's just going to be rusty.
Hey, John, we only have a minute left, but you can take off your CNN hat and put on your Dorchester hat. 50 games into the season. We were worried if the Red Sox had lost 11 in a row yesterday, you'd be too sad to even call in. Luckily, they won. Is it over after 50 games for the likes of John King?
It's not over, but they got a lot of holes, and they look a little laggard. Now, let's hope that yesterday was the turnaround, and they're going to win 10 in a row now. They need to... the interesting thing is they signed Stephen Drew, and what's the best thing happening for them right now is Bogarts and Brock Holt, right? So they've addressed the one problem they don't have, the left side of the infield. let's see what happens. I'm not giving up. I told you I've been texting back and forth. The buddy might have moved to Texas, and he says 90 losses. I'm not giving up yet, but they're dangerous. In that division is going to keep beating itself up. You have to win the division because the wild card's not going to come out of the East. The wild card's going to come out of the West or the Central. So if they want to make the playoffs, they got to win the division this year. That's my guess, looking at the standings right now. And so they better snap out of it fast.
Thanks
couldn't
to the ever-optimistic John
you see
King.
John What's King a, segueing so easily into, you know,
to the manager's sports, uniform.
Sports broadcasting.
Forget broadcasting. Let him manage a damn team.
Okay, let
John,
him own a team. If things go right, he's in the lottery.
Alive.
Yeah.
John, it's great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you, John, as always. John King is CNN's chief national correspondent. He hosts Inside Politics. You can catch that 8:30 a.m. Sundays on CNN. Always great to talk to him. Coming up, today, Jared Remy pled guilty to first-degree murder in the death of his former girlfriend, Jennifer Martel. We'll talk to David Frank from Mass Lawyers Weekly about that very unusual plea. That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
I'm Bob C. Tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition, should nurses with advanced degrees be allowed to help fill in for the growing shortage of primary care physicians? That story tomorrow only on WGBH's Morning Edition.
Here in New England, many employers offer matching gift programs. So your gift to WGBH could be doubled or even tripled without your spending another dime. Learn more at wgbh.org/matching gifts.
Funding for our programs comes from you and North Shore Music Theater's production of Anything Goes, the High Seas musical featuring Cole Porter's classic songs You're the Top, DeLovely, Friendship, and many more. Anything Goes, playing June 3rd through the 15th, nsmt.org. And Leahy Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at leahyhealth.org. That's leahyhealth.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. This morning in Middlesex Superior Court, Jared Remy, son of famed Red Sox announcer Jerry Remy, pled guilty to first-degree murder in the death of his former girlfriend, Jennifer Martel. Here is Remy pleading guilty. The other voice you'll hear is that of Judge Kathy Tutman.
Mr. Remy, did you hear and understand the facts that were just stated to the court by the assistant district attorney?
Yes, I did.
Did you, in fact, do those acts that were just described to the court by the assistant district attorney?
Yes, I did.
Are there any facts that you say are different from the facts that you have just heard summarized?
Yes, I do.
And could you tell me about that, please?
I got, she had a knife in her hand. She was threatening me about my daughter. That's the only difference.
Do you understand that by pleading guilty, Mr. Remy, you are admitting that the facts just related to the court by the assistant district attorney are true?
Yes, I do.
Do you now plead guilty to these indictments willingly and voluntarily?
Yes, I do.
This comes just days after a young man made a chilling video, I'm sure you've all seen, then went hunting for women. We'll discuss the ultimate war on women with you in a couple of minutes, but first, joining us on the line to talk about this Remy plea is David Frank. David, as you know, is a lawyer. He's managing editor for Mass Lawyers Weekly. David, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So, David, my first question is, I've heard many times pleading guilty to second-degree murder. This is unusual to plead guilty to first-degree murder, is it not?
It is. I mean, Jared Remy basically got the same sentence today that he would have received if he had gone to trial and been convicted on every single indictment brought against him. So the Middlesex DA's office held all the cards in that he was facing a mandatory life in prison sentence if he were to be convicted of first-degree murder, and he pled to the highest charge that he was facing. So it is unusual. You don't see it all that often where a defendant who basically gains nothing in terms of a sentence by taking an early plea opts to do so, but that's what Jared Remy did today.
So what do you think this was about? I mean, why? Why do this? I mean, you could possibly be acquitted. It didn't look good, but there's a possibility there.
Certainly. I mean, as horrific as the facts of this case were and that Remy has now pled to, you were talking about a situation where there was at least the possibility of a mental health type defense. The possibility is Ed Ryan, Remy's lawyer, said after court today of some sort of a defense related to the abuse of steroids. I mean, those are uphill battles, clearly, but they at least had the possibility of some measure of hope, either for a lesser sentence of second-degree murder or manslaughter. As to why, I mean, Ed Ryan tried to explain it. I don't know that we'll ever know. I mean, you could theorize that Jared Remy, who really made a point today to try to separate his parents from what he had admitted to doing, maybe it was to spare the parents the trial. Maybe it was to spare his young daughter, who was a potential witness. I mean, unlikely, but a potential witness. There are any number of reasons. We really don't know. But I was surprised. I didn't see it coming, even after last week when Judge Tutman held a lobby conference that was essentially sealed. I still didn't think there'd be a plea, because I didn't think there was any way the Middlesex DA's office would offer a lesser sentence on second-degree murder, and I just didn't think Remy would plead a first.
We're talking to David Frank. He's the managing editor of Mass Lawyers Weekly. We saw and heard Jennifer Martell's parents were there. Jared Remy's parents were not, and there was an explanation, correct?
There was. Ed Ryan said that Jared Remy specifically instructed his parents not to come. And Remy gave he had a written statement prepared that he read to the court, and most of it was aimed at asking people not to blame his parents. So Ed Ryan said that Jared Remy asked his parents not to be there. I noticed that Jared Remy wasn't on the broadcast yesterday in Atlanta. I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but certainly between last week when Jared Remy was last in court and today, there had to be a lot of talking going on amongst the lawyers, amongst the family, and he certainly wasn't there today, Jared Remy says it was because he asked him not to be.
David, I think I heard this, but I want to clarify with you. I believe during the press conference that Ed Ryan, the lawyer for Jared Remy, was asked after the plea whether the Remys, meaning Jared's parents, had advised him in any fashion to plead guilty. Am I right that there was that question? Because I know the response to whatever question I heard was no. Was that actually asked?
There's been a lot asked in the last couple of minutes here. It's been busy. I think there was certainly a question to that effect, and Ed Ryan obviously didn't go anywhere close to that. The conversations he has with his client are privileged, and you can understand why a lawyer wouldn't want to necessarily share communications that he might be privy to between the client and a parent.
Did you say, David, at the minute when Marjorie was...
But he talks to you all the time, Jim. He'll probably tell you.
Well, in the spirit of full disclosure, Ed is not only the lawyer, he's not only a close friend of mine, but he's represented me in a matter
That's right.
that we will not...
Jim's shady past.
No, it's...
you're saying it's not the first time that Ed Ryan has had his hands full with a difficult client.
That is correct.
Well, maybe so.
David Frank.
Can we go back to the first thing Marjorie raised? Have you ever... I'm trying to think. Obviously, I don't do what you
remember.
I can't remember ever someone pleading to first-degree murder. Can you?
The problem is, if I say yes, then you're going to ask me what case.
Yeah, I am going to ask you that. So
I can't think of it. I'm racking my brain, which you know, you can insert any joke you want. I know it's happened. I know it's happened. It doesn't happen often for the reasons we just described, and it is very unusual. I'm comfortable as the lawyer on the radio show saying that it's very unusual. There certainly are times when you're talking about death penalty cases where the government agrees to take death off the table in exchange for the life sentence, but you do not see this very often.
That's well, by the way, I assume that's the hope. I mean, speaking of courtrooms, if you go a bit away to a federal courtroom
right.
in South Boston, I assume the hope of the expert on death penalty cases, what is it, Judy Clark for Jahar Tsarnaev, I assume that's their goal, is that ultimately the prosecutors allow him in that case to plead guilty and get life as opposed to the death penalty, which is on the table. So I guess the question was, and I'm sure it's what you're thinking about, a situation where, as you said to Marjorie, where there is nothing that is gained, at least in concrete terms, by the defendant. Here, there's no discretion on the part of the judge. That's the circumstance that I can't ever think of, and apparently nor can you.
No, and I looked back. I looked through the archives of Lawyers Weekly and through my brain. Can't think of one, but I do know from anecdotally from my DA days, I can think of a case here, a case there, where it might have happened. But again, you're going to say which one, and I'm going to say I don't know.
Well, you know, I think there is something to be gained here for Jared Remy, and that is that he's not going to torture his parents any more than he already has. I mean, Jerry Remy, we're going to talk about this later in the show. There's been a lot of debate whether Jerry Remy should continue his career as a sportscaster. Clearly, this was a big theme of Jared Remy's talk this morning. Don't blame my parents. Jared Remy wrote me somewhat of a hostile letter from jail at the Boston Herald, and that was the theme of that letter, too. Don't blame my parents. My parents have nothing to do with this. So apparently he has hugely impassioned feelings about this. So he does have that.
Well, there's also another half to the story involving you. The only person who, not by name, but who's specifically been singled out by the father and described as disgusting is you in some of your earlier columns about the family and seeking custody of their granddaughter. Right. David, so this is over, yes? I mean, there's no more, correct?
It's over. No, right. Jared Remy, I mean, interestingly enough, there's still the jail fight that Remy was recently charged with, where he's accused of an incident at the jail. That case is actually in Cambridge District Court. I was surprised today that the lawyers hadn't already worked out a deal, but clearly that is not going to change the sentence. Those are misdemeanor offenses in district court. Today really does mark the last meaningful event in the Jared Remy court saga. There's still going to be lots of questions, and I agree with what you were saying, that it certainly seemed to Jared Remy, that the interest in saving his parents from a trial was a big factor. But Ed Ryan and any other lawyer will tell you that that's not an easy situation for the lawyer.
Because
that might be a good reason for the defendant. But the lawyer representing this particular client has to be really careful that the client is making the decision for the right reason. And that just complicated, an already complicated case.
And we should say, by the way, Ed, who's the former president of the Mass Bar, is a wildly competent lawyer. He's a really good
He's
one.
A great
takes
guy.
A lot of cases.
He's a great guy.
For virtually nothing, representing very poor people, not putting Remy in that category. Hey, David Frank, editor of Mass Lawyers Weekly, thank you for your time. As always, really appreciate it.
Anytime. Nice to talk to you both.
Thank you, David.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Right before we spoke to Jared, I mentioned the video.
You didn't speak to Jared.
Pardon me. We spoke to David Frank. I mentioned a video that virtually everybody has seen. We're going to play a little piece of this. This, of course, is Elliot Rodger, the shooter at UC Santa Barbara. This is a video he required, put up on YouTube prior to the shooting spree, detailing sexual frustrations and threatening what he called retribution.
On the day of retribution, I am going to enter the hottest sorority house of UCSB. And I will slaughter every single spoiled, stuck-up, blonde slut I see inside there. All those girls that I've desired so much.
You know, there is a common thread, Marjorie and I were talking about this morning, between the Elliot Rodger rampage out in California and Jared Remy's murder of Jennifer Martella's girlfriend. And the interesting thing in both of these circumstances, Marjorie, after Jennifer Martell was killed, on social media you saw everywhere women describing having been in similar situations with an abusive, controlling boyfriend. Luckily, in those cases, they weren't killed. And this, you saw Twitter exploded after this Elliot Rodger thing with women talking about how many situations they'd been in where they felt similarly threatened, where they can never walk alone anymore, where they go to a party and every single person as they walk in grabs their behind. So what we want to talk to you about for the next handful of minutes, 877-301-8970, is not so much the details of the Jared Remy thing, but about whether or not these two cases, the resolution of the Remy case and the actual murder over the weekend out there in California, suggest the ultimate war on women, not the political one that we hear so much when we're talking about presidential campaigns.
Well, this is a very broad umbrella because we just had the White House, the reports from the White House about sexual abuse against female students all across the country. It's been on the front pages of papers here locally.
Investigating 55 universities.
Yes, and how women at these colleges, are raped or sexually assaulted, and there's never any – I shouldn't say never – there's often no satisfaction, that you know, the colleges want to keep it very hush-hush. We now have pepper spray. Everybody can get pepper spray now in Massachusetts because there were those attacks in the North End. A wrong man was accused of those, but we now can go buy pepper spray because everyone is afraid, not everyone is afraid, but many people are afraid of walking alone. And you see this in the internet too. I think that there's a lot more upfront hostility. They were calling it on CNN, sort of this rage against women that you see on commenting on stories. You know, just like you see that the racist comments about, we were talking about that NHL hockey player a couple of weeks ago,
Subban,
that scored the winning goal against the Bruins. These attacks on women about how women look and what women say and how women dress. Maybe I'm crazy, but it seems much more intense to me now than it used to. And part of that is the internet.
Did you read this? Yes, all women was the hashtag. Did you read this? Some of the postings after the killings out there in Santa Barbara. I mean, women. I only read 100, maybe 200 of them. Thousands, if not tens, if not hundreds of thousands of women talk about how they have to live their lives because of people like Elliot Rodger,
right,
the vast majority of whom don't do something nearly as horrific, but do assault, harass, bully, and do all those kinds of things to women.
And there's another big piece of this, which was nowhere near as prevalent, 20 years ago, with pre-internet, the ease with which young men, teenage boys, look at pornography that is very dehumanizing to women, mm-hmm, obviously. And before, you used to have to make an effort. You have to go get Playboy magazine. Playboy magazine would not be, I think, called hardcore pornography that you see online. Now we have all these stories about young men basically being addicted to looking at these pictures of women in horrible situations for hours. So it's just, and the constant belittling, this drives me crazy, of women who are heavy. You know, this constant belittling, talking about women's looks. Hillary Clinton, how many times do we have to hear about Hillary Clinton being old and being having a bad figure? I mean, really, I think we've gone there a million times before. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. So do you get the sense that there is more hostility toward women in general? And if so, where's it come from? Why is this? Why is this that people seem to be more afraid than ever? And the sexual assaults in college campuses are seemingly increasing by huge amounts.
So what's your answer? I'll give you
my
quick answer.
I gave you some of my answers.
What is it?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think the internet has made it really horrible for weirdos to get on there and sort of make the weird, disgusting comments seem not so weird and disgusting.
It may be part of that. And the anonymity, which we've discussed ad nauseum here, is part of it. It's also men are threatened by women more than they ever have been before. I don't mean physically threatened. Jobs, pay,
right,
all that sort of thing.
You should be threatened here,
okay,
in the studio.
877-301-8970. By the way, don't waste your time and call and say, well, all men are not getting a gun and shooting every woman they can find on a campus. And all men are not Jared Remy. We're not saying they are. But what we are saying is it may be symptomatic of an upsurge in really horrible treatment of women, obviously in those cases leading to the ultimate mistreatment of women, murder.
Well, one last thing we should say about Jared Remy before we take the calls is that, as you may recall, Jennifer Martel, the woman he killed, was the fifth woman that he'd beaten. And this was over 20 years and 19 arrests, I think it was, or maybe 18 years and 19 arrests. I'm in the ballpark anyway. And he was over and over again let off by judges. And by the way, one of the sad things about the plea this morning, he pled guilty to first-degree murder. We will not hear from these judges. The case is over, and that's the end of it. 877-301-8970. Let's start with Andrea in New Hampshire. Hi, Andrea.
Hey, Andrea.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
I have lost three jobs being sexually assaulted at work and within the last 10 years or so. The last 4 years, twice. And when I reported what was happening, they retaliated and fired me. So I went to Mass, MCAD, which is a discrimination. I've lost my livelihood, you know, three times because of this. But I wasn't going to, you know, how could I stand for that? And I will tell you that the person who did it the last time at a large company right now, he was a person I knew 25 years ago and had what I didn't realize was this crazy crush. So, but he got so abusive. And when it was just like all of a sudden the light bulb went off, and I said, I can't let this happen to me. And this is in IT, which is very difficult. It's a difficult position to get to for a woman. I'm trying to break into that. You know, I finally get in, and I had to leave after 6 months.
Hey, Andrea, are you an outlier at the places you've worked, or have other women who have been your colleagues had similar sorts of experiences?
Interestingly enough, when I reported him to HR, the girl said, you think you're the only one this is happening to in this company? I was floored. I was like, and you've known this like for how long? So yes, I think there's a lack of respect and civility in general towards women because of things like the heightened sense of you can get sex anywhere. You know, the internet is a huge, you know, an enabler, I guess you could say, because there's nobody watching your back. There's nobody to say. And, you know, the guys in the office, I was alone, and I worked 7 to 7 at night, and the guys in the office saw it constantly, and they were afraid to say anything, too. And when they were, the whole thing was reported, and they did an investigation, and the guys that, you know, that I worked with said, oh, we were sick and tired of him putting his hand over your hand on the mouse and saying, hey, let me draw it. Like, is this, that's okay?
Andrea, wish you luck, and
thank you very much for the call, and good luck in future jobs. That is horrible. That is absolutely horrible.
877-301-8897. But aren't you the one who said Anita Hill changed the whole world? Haven't you said that thousands of times?
Well, she changed it to the sense that you can go complain to somebody. Mm-hmm. I mean, before Anita Hill, you just had to run faster than the person that was chasing you around the desk and make sure you weren't alone with them. At least now you have someplace to go. So I'm not saying by any means she made it perfect. She just made it better. I forgot to mention one very important thing.
That?
Look at the military assaults that are going on the weekend after Veterans Days. I mean, all these stories about women. The generals and the captains and the higher-ups are attacking
them.
The
men in charge of investigating sexual assaults in the military are found guilty of sexual assaults. Let's go to Eric in Western Mass. You're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And hi, Eric.
Hi there. On the one hand, I certainly agree that there is this, for want of a better term, war on women that we see reflected in all aspects of the culture, the news media, the entertainment industry, et cetera. On the other hand, I think that to take this kid out in California, Elliot Rodgers, and what he did as an example of the war on women, I think probably misses the point a little bit, simply because what we're dealing with in that situation, it seems to me, I spent a little time reading his manifesto.
I read some of it too, yeah.
And what it seems to me we're dealing with there is really a confluence of, on the one hand, mental illness, and on the other hand, raging hormones of a teenager, and finally a kid who underwent some pretty horrific bullying by his own account, some pretty detailed episodes.
Eric, I agree. I read a decent amount of that manifesto too, and I watched the YouTube video a couple of times. But if you went to this, the hashtag Yes All Women, you would find mountains of women saying they had the exact same kind of comments made about them by people who weren't Elliot Rodgers. So I'm not suggesting he's not far worse in terms of mental illness than the average man who is treating a woman poorly. But I guess what we were saying is it's symptomatic of treating women as lesser beings. But Eric, thank you for your call.
But you know what I thought was interesting from his manifesto is that he was obsessed with these really good-looking young women in sororities, these blonde, I'm not going to use the word he used, these spoiled, stuck-up young women. He was going to go to the hottest sorority. So you wonder whether this was a man that was rejected by women that were, as we used to say when I was a kid, totally out of your league. You know, that he was resentful of, because there's this faux idea of the ideal woman. And, you know, you can't be dating a woman that may be 5 pounds overweight, or maybe she has acne on her forehead, or maybe she's got some other small physical flaw. And you wonder whether that was this kid's experience. He thought he should get the hottest girl around, and when he didn't, he went into a rage.
Well, but come back to Massachusetts, and Jared Remy thought that he had the ability to tell his girlfriend and her mother, it's her mother, right, mm-hmm. when to go to sleep, when to go up. How many times did he call her on one of those things? Like
17
times when she went out.
She was at the mall.
I mean, the controlling aspect, and by the way, I'm not, again, suggesting that's not aberrationally extreme. How many situations do you hear about that kind of control that ends up leading to violence? It appears to be an epidemic. Let's go to Carolyn. You're in Western Mass. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Carolyn.
Hi.
Hi.
I think women are in an untenable position. I mean, if you look at society, I don't see one role model or one archetype that's healthy. I mean, from rap music to stuff you see on the internet, and then if you turn to religion, there's such a stratified positions for women. Even the Pope hasn't made strides in that respect. He says we'll find a new positions for women. What is cheerleaders? nun pom poms or something? I don't know what women can do. And I remember when I was young, and I'm old now. I mean, you would have to endure catcalls as you're walking down the street. Now it's on the internet. I mean, you have international catcalls. I mean, we have Kim Kardashian as a role model for women. We have every woman airbrushed so that, the ideal beauty is like a freak. It's like, it's really frightening. I would not want to be a younger woman today.
Carolyn, thank you for a fine call. We appreciate it.
Christopher emails about the violence in Hollywood films against women, and he's absolutely right about that. They're just unbelievably brutal. And Scott says, this morning alone, he's heard three references to Hillary Clinton's cankles.
Yeah.
So there you go.
You made a wonderful point. Let's take one or two more quick ones. Linnell, you're in Sandwich. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Linnell.
Hi, how are you?
We're good, thank you.
Good. I think this is such a critical conversation, and I've been talking to people for the last couple of days about how much the national public discourse has been devoted to this issue. It is the culture, and we have problems in the culture, and there's a really good example of Massachusetts that you're probably both aware of. Massachusetts was the first state to pass equal pay for women in 1947, yet we are 13th currently in implementing that. So there was a good discussion. It may have even been on your program, but there was a good discussion on public
radio
about
that. Shocking,
isn't it? And a young, very bright political person, somebody teaching, was asked that question, why have we not changed? And she said, it's the culture. I think that was a profound answer. Implementation of any good idea in terms of how we should be evolving in a culture is only as good as we make it.
Yeah, speaking of equal pay, I heard this great, not great, it was depressing, a story on this station, 89.7, on the news, I think it was yesterday morning, talking about venture capitalists. And they need to invest in companies to get them going, and that only 4% of the venture capitalist money in America goes to firms, companies that are run by women. So that was pretty bleak and depressing, too. Thank you for the call. I wanted to mention, too, another horrific murder that happened in Boston that was just totally all about attacking women, the Amy Lord killing. She was just coming out of her apartment in South Boston. This guy didn't know her from Adam. He just saw a woman. He grabbed her. He put her in his car, and he killed her. He'd attacked another woman before that. He attacked another woman that night. He'd been attacking women just because he had this rage against women. So you say, God, I mean, I don't know. Has this always been there? It does seem to be more virulent and more deadly of late.
Well, hopefully it does provoke a conversation. By the way, we're going to return to the Jared Remy discussion later, particularly the issue of the fate of his father, who some people believe was an enabler.
Up next, though, we're going to talk to Harvard historian Nancy Kang. She's going to talk about pomp in these circumstances. What makes a great commencement speech, and what do today's graduates need to hear? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Valuable playtime.
Play is an essential part of being a young human being. It's essential to social life, and it's also essential to physiological and brain development.
When students lose out on recess, education suffers, even if staying off the playground avoids discipline problems in some schools. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Support for our programs comes from you and Xconomy.com, presenting Boston 2034 on June 10th, exploring the ideas, innovators, and companies poised to drive the economy in the years to come. More at Xconomy.com/Boston2034. And Gentle Giant Moving Company, serving New England since 1980. now offering moving and storage services coast to coast with offices in major cities across the country. More info at gentlegiant.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Just over 1.5 million students will graduate from college this year. So is it possible for a commencement address to resonate with the endless waves of 20-somethings in their caps and gowns? Here with us in Studio 3 to look at the anatomy of the graduation speech is Nancy Kane. Nancy's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hello there, Nancy.
Hey there.
Hello, Nancy. Good to see you. So you think that you have found a fantastic commencement speech?
I'm not alone in this assessment. So the one, my favorite commencement speech, and I, you know, have looked at some from the earlier 20th century as well as more recent ones, is David Foster Wallace's address in the summer or the late spring of 2007 before Kenyon College in Ohio. It has a big, big internet following, and it is. And for all of our listeners that want to read it, it bears not only listening. You can listen to it or watch it on YouTube because he was filmed giving it, and you can read it in transcription. It goes by the title "This Is Water." It was titled officially the 2007 commencement speech, but it's become known as the "This Is Water" speech. And there's even, believe it or not, this is how popular it is, a short, like action movie of it. So you can see that as well with fish, complete with fish, because this is water obtained to the opening paragraph about fish swimming around. And this astounding kind of crystallizing scene that he describes in the middle of the speech about the boredom and tedium and self-centeredness of adult life.
You teach this, do you not?
I teach a big hunk of this, actually teach several hunks of it, but particularly the part of the end of the speech to executives. He talks a lot in the speech about our default settings, because the premise of the address, and this is what's so interesting, is that he says, yeah, and he's very, very careful to kind of upend every single cliche about commencement speeches, to call them out and then try and turn them on their head. He says, you know, every single commencement speech talks about how you've come to college to learn to how to think. And he says, yes, that sounds condescending. Yes, it's a cliche. But there's something incredibly truthful about it. And it's less about how you think than that that you have the choice about what to think. And so the whole speech is about how we frame things, you know, how we look at different moments in our life. And he just kind of takes that like it's like he's making, covering a strawberry with chocolate, layer after layer after layer of meaning around how we choose to see ourselves and where we are in a certain moment and how that changes everything.
Now, in a second, we're going to play a little piece of what Foster Wallace did out there. So you get a sense, you can hear his voice and I think be more a part of this. But before we do, tell the fish piece from the opening paragraph, just so people understand how he set this thing up.
So the opening is about, is two young fish. He's describing this, two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish who says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a little bit, and then eventually, and now I'm reading this, one of them looks over at the other and goes, "What the hell is water?"
And his point is what?
His point is that, you know, that we are so conditioned to falling into our default settings, ways of viewing, you know, a line in the grocery store, ways of viewing the fact that the Starbucks coffee we just got wasn't made the right way, ways of viewing, you know, a particular piece of news we just got at the office, that we forget that what's actually really happening, that that's the only way we can see what's really happening right now. We're not paying attention to anything else other than the reaction we've just had to a particular event or happenstance. And so we forget that this is water. What the hell is water? My Starbucks coffee didn't taste very good. And so it's a fascinating. I mean, I said to one of my, to a group of executives I was coaching, I think this is one of the most profound pieces of prose I have ever read. And I include, remember, I love Lincoln and Shakespeare, so I'm putting Wallace in good company here. Because of the very, in some ways, the astounding simplicity and at the same time, the astounding difficulty of what he is saying about the choice we have moment by moment to think, stay present, and try and summon up empathy for ourselves and others so that we're not just defaulting into what is my experience right now at the center of my skull-sized kingdom.
Here is a little bit of David Foster Wallace, just to give you a taste of what he was like that day.
Look, the insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful. It is that they are unconscious. They are default settings. They're the kind of worship you just gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. And the so-called real world will not discourage you from operating on your default settings, because the so-called real world of men and money and power hums merrily along on the fuel of fear and anger and frustration and craving and the worship of self. Our own present culture has harnessed these forces in ways that have yielded extraordinary wealth and comfort and personal freedom. The freedom all to be lords of our own tiny skull-sized kingdoms, alone at the center of all creation.
Okay, Nancy, what'd you make of that section of the speech?
So I think this is a piece that I use in
Nancy has a knowing smile on her face, by the way, I should say, as she's speaking. Well, good.
I just love this piece. This is in some sense just past the denouement of the speech, the inflection point of, you know, what's the point in really concentrating on how we're thinking about things and, if you will, walking around the statue. I like to talk to executives about, if this moment or this event or this person or this problem or this fire you're trying to put out, think of it as Michelangelo's statue in the Academia of David, the David statue.
Yes.
And you can still, you know, even in this day of vandalism of artworks, you can walk around it, and it looks very different whether you're looking at the back of David or the side of David or the front of David or just, you know, kind of at 11 o'clock on David. And so what Wallace is saying is we can look at a given moment or ourselves or this event in a lot of different ways. And we can choose, literally, where around the statue we stand and look. And that's incredibly powerful. And so when he says, look, the insidious things about all these worship is not that they're evil. And he's talking about worship of power, worship of money, worship of beauty, worship of fame, the things that we tend to live in a society in which collectively we value those things and put them high on our list of what we should be or want to be or should have. He's saying, look, the problem is that that's unconscious. We never stop to look at whether that is really the whole story, or even the most important story, or even the story we want to write about our lives. And he goes on in the next paragraph or two. I really recommend, good listeners, do not pass go, do not collect $200. Go read the speech, especially the last half. He's saying, look, you know, our world won't discourage you from looking at those, from getting out of those default things. But if you do, you're going to discover not only something more interesting, something more true, something more connected, something more, you know, more enriching and freeing. You are going to discover, you know, the essence of what constitutes the good life. And it's an essence that's not a holy grail. It's not something you get like Rocky in the first, you know, movie, running up the Philadelphia Art Museum steps when he's in shape and like shaking his arms and after he's drunk the raw eggs. It's not like that at all. It's an accretive set of choices we make every single day to not operate solely on default settings, but to operate from a perspective of what we are, how we are connected to each other, and how we are connected to something other than worship of money, worship of self, worship of power.
Well, you know, when he says in here too, if you worship power, you'll end up feeling weak and afraid, and you'll need even more power. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. Same thing about worshiping, you know, your old beauty and sexual allure. You're eventually going to be old and decrepit. And you know what else I found in here? That there's a lot of Buddhism in here. I don't know if he was a Buddhist in his real life, but the whole idea in Buddhism of people are not the enemy and have compassion for people instead of viewing the person in the checkout line as your enemy because they're in front of you with an extra item in the checkout, which we all do.
We all do that.
We all do. I just found it unbelievably wise for a man that was not that old. I mean,
he's so wise. I was driving over here thinking, my God, you know, he finishes this piece. You know, maybe he finishes the night before, maybe he finishes 3 weeks before. This is so well written. He's thought about it so carefully. It sounds impromptu, but there's nothing impromptu about this. It's like Lincoln, right? He's really run this through the wire mesh of good writing. And I thought, how proud at some level he must have been to, you know, kind of print out the pages and carry them up to the podium because it is so wise. And yet, you know, it took him a while to peel back the layers of this onion to get here, because most of his writing is not leading to this. He wrote widely. He wrote on varied subjects. He wrote fiction. He wrote prose. He did journalism. This is its own genre and its own gospel, and it is very, very powerful.
And by the way, the horrible end of the story is not that long after this. He took his own life, right? How long after this was
So it? He gave this speech in the spring of 2005, and he hung himself in his home in California in early September 2007. Mm-hmm. He had battled, as his parents later said publicly, with very serious depression for more than 20 years. So I believe he was something like 46 when he died. So he's a relatively young man who had spent his adult life dealing with depression.
So when you're teaching this, or when you're executive coaching, what's the takeaway? Other than how brilliant what's the transferable thing?
Here's the takeaway. The takeaway is at the end of this you know, kind of set of paragraphs that our listeners just heard, where he says, look, there are lots of kinds of freedom, but the freedom that you won't heard much talked about in the great outside world of winning, displaying, you know, and succeeding, is the freedom to care about others in a myriad of sexy, petty ways over and over every day. That is real freedom. That is not operating on your default settings. That, right, is this sense of having access to some infinite thing. And the reason I end a lot of my work, especially if I've done multi-sessions, you know, it's a week and we've had four or five sessions together, I end this, you know, our work together with a group of, say, 40, 50 high-powered executives on this note is because of this. I have learned over the last 25 years or more of studying leaders, by past and present, that the most effective leadership, when you're really trying to move the mountain in toward a worthy place, is all about the ability of the leader to literally connect in petty, unsexy ways with all the different people all the way down the chain or across the chain of stakeholders that have to help move the mountain in petty, unsexy ways. So great leadership actually begins with getting out of the default settings of, oh my God, we're going to get this kind of, you know, bottom line or this kind of earnings per share this week or we're going to crumble. It begins with, here's who I am and why I think we should head for Damascus this way, and why you and my the internal connection I have to you, any person that I'm talking to or leading, why that connection is going to help us get to Damascus. So you got to get rid of the default settings, or at least you got to let them loose and operate in a broader frame to lead toward any kind of successful impact. And I want to remind lots of alpha males and alpha females, silverback gorillas, that it's not just the default settings.
That's Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. Nancy, can we talk about a couple of other memorable ones make most people's... Well, one makes a top 10 list. Somebody we've talked to you a lot about in 2005, same year as this one, Steve Jobs gives a commencement speech at Stanford. And what I've read about it this morning are two things. One, the great little anecdote, which I love, is he hired a speechwriter, and the speechwriter, he stood him up. And Steve Jobs.
Can you believe that? Stood up Steve Jobs. We sat at his kitchen table, you know, in Palo Alto and wrote the speech, and it's a great speech.
And that's the second thing people say about it. It's the most self-revelatory thing people say that Jobs has ever spoken or written. What was the essence of his thing?
So the essence of the speech is very short. You can watch him deliver it in beard and pink gown or maroon gown for Stanford colors on YouTube.
Marjorie's alma mater,
say. That's right.
And mine as well.
Really?
Yeah. And he tells three different stories. He tells the story of going to Reed College and dropping out and what he learned after he dropped out. He tells the story of getting cancer and basically live each day like it's your last. Those are the first and the third stories. And the middle story is about getting kicked out of Apple in the mid-80s when John Sculley, the former CEO of Pepsi, came in and took over. Like, he wanted an adult at the wheel. And he got kicked out, and how disappointed he was and how hurt. And yet, how all of these different pieces, right, the dropping out of Reed College and the calligraphy he learned that then comes to influence the typography of the Mac, what he learned after getting kicked out at Apple at Next and Pixar, and how that comes to affect what will become the next round when he comes back to Apple in the late 1990s, the next round of computers, and then the the iPhone and the iPad, and I'm just forgetting the i the little
iPod.
Thank iPod. You. Oh my God! Because the iPhone is the iPod and the iPod, and then the last piece is about his first bout with pancreatic cancer and what it felt like when the doctors thought he was going to die in 90 days. He would later, he would go on to have at least like six more years. And how that changed him. And so the point of the speech is these three morals: live like tomorrow's your last, connect the dots, right? You drop out of Reed College, but guess what? Everything you do there still ends up mattering. And sometimes failure, as Oprah Winfrey said in last year's Harvard commencement, is fail. Sometimes failure is just another way of the universe turning you in a new direction, right? Because leaving Apple in the mid-'80s actually turned out to be really great for Apple and Steve Jobs in 1997 when he came back. And the last piece of the story of the address, which is really probably the most quoted part of the address, besides connect the dots in your life, consciously choose to connect the dots, is this. And it comes from the Whole Earth Catalog, which some of our listeners will remember.
Oh, yes.
From the 1960s Stuart Brand's book. It is stay hungry, stay foolish. And yeah. So it's, you know, it's delivered in a terribly humane, uncharacteristically humane and humble way. It has this huge cult-like following because I think a lot of people want to believe that Steve Jobs was probably not as much of a jerk as he certainly was at times, and he's not a jerk at all in this speech. And it's a wonderful commencement speech told from the heart. So that is a great speech, and it's short.
When does Harvard graduate? June's what?
They're graduating this week.
This week.
Harvard's
okay.
graduating this week.
Michael Bloomberg
is the commencement speaker. And just a plug for the Harvard Business School, Saul Kahn is going to deliver our class day speech, which I think is fabulous. Wow.
Fantastic. He's the guy
from
that
the
does
Kahn,
all the online.
Kahn Academy, yep.
Yes. So tell us a little bit about Jill Abrams. We're going to play a piece of her before we get to her. But to put this in context, she had just been canned at the New York Times, could have canceled this speech at Wake Forest. But didn't she
cancel a Brandeis or something, Margaret?
I
think she canceled a local speech and then did Wake Forest. Anyway,
I don't know, but let's hear a little bit of Jill Abramson, who, of course, was the executive editor of the New York Times, speaking at Wake Forest just a couple of days after she did get canned.
What's next for me? I don't know. So I'm in exactly the same boat as many of you.
Now, I love this speech. Other people disagree with me, but I thought it showed an incredible sense of humor and resilience, yeah, which was her theme, days after losing the job that she loved.
I agree. I didn't hear it. That's the first I've heard her voice, but I read it. And it's interesting because it's really, so far, her only public comment in any way on what happened at the Times, which I gather was relatively unexpected. Right?
Totally,
It was not a long fuse here that's, you know, that I think she and lots of other people in the newsroom had any idea was coming. So I thought it showed not only resilience, I think that's a really important word here and a really important word for our moment in history, for young and older Americans, but also a kind of grace under pressure, if you will.
Yes.
So what she didn't do is jump into the fray and start sort of, you know, slinging arrows of outrageous fortune and infamy at her former employers at the time. She did none of that. She said really basically nothing until she went to Wake Forest and could not only kind of take the mickey of herself, right, make, you know, sort of laugh at herself, but do it with grace and, an old-fashioned word, a kind of aplomb, right, a kind of calm, dignity, and composure. And some humor, and I give her lots of credit
that,
right? To walk in there with her head tall, and she said, by the way, in the speech, for those of our listeners that haven't heard it, she said, I'm going to stay in journalism. It's what I love. I want to get the story. I don't know exactly how that's going to play out. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't have another job, but I'm going to stay in the game, which reminded me of another great commencement speech, which you can read online, by Winston Churchill in 1944 at the Harrow School, a private school in England, secondary school, where he just, this is 1944, so the war's not over, right? D-Day has not happened, and he's never give in, back to resilience and persistence. Another great speech by a great speechwriter, short, to the point, but full of, you know, if you will, you know, tools for our tool belt that we want to wear for our lives.
What's your take on the controversy of the season and past seasons? Condoleezza Rice, being essentially asked not to do her thing at Rutgers, Lagarde not at the head of the IMF being asked not to do her thing at Smith. You know, there's this whole controversy about freedom of speech. And I have to say, my attitude about this is, if you're having someone to speak on campus, then anybody and everybody who's got credentials should be able to speak. And obviously, you respond to that. But this whole notion that students are being reviled, the former head of Princeton is trashing students somewhere the other day for having caused, who I can't remember who it is, whoever the speaker was, to back out. This is the day for the students, it seems to me. It's not this whole notion that anybody with any worldview should be able to speak. I have to say, I'm not with on that particular day.
I mean, I think we're making a great mountain out of a small molehill, a hillock, as we'd say in England here. The First Amendment guarantees freedom of speech. That's not just freedom for Christine Lagarde to talk about IMF policies when it was mostly faculty that turned the corner at Smith, as I read the news reports.
It wasn't at Rutgers with Rice, though. It was faculty and students.
Well, in fact, students were involved in Smith, too. But what sounds like the petition that kind of shifted the equation for the publicity people at the IMF and Lagarde was a petition by 120 faculty members. So freedom of speech exists everywhere. Lagarde is free to say what she will about IMF development programs or IMF security programs.
But it doesn't give her a right to speak anywhere she wants,
No, but she's free to say that at Smith if she comes invited and actually comes.
Course.
And students and faculty are free to protest that. So if in the end, the different freedoms, end up with Lagarde saying, her people saying, this is not good policy for us to go in this kind of environment, and the folks at Rutgers say students are too upset, so sorry, Condoleezza, or sorry, Ms. Rice, then I don't see that there's anything kind of condemning on either side about this. This is how it played out. In general, who decides what who the commencement speaker will be varies institution by institution. So in lots of institutions, students vote on the commencement speaker, right? And then that subject,
I'm all for that.
But in others, administrations choose. So and so I think we don't really have a grand kind of postulate
but I guess my question is, if students protest and as a result a speaker pulls out, what's the harm? They exercise their right and the speaker chose not to be there.
You know what the harm is to me in some of these situations is that the students do things that are really stupid. And I remember when Barbara Bush came to speak at Wellesley College, and she was it wasn't about her being the wife of Republican George Bush. It was about her having dropped out of college to become a mother. And Wellesley was all up in arms. This wasn't a great example. And it's true, a lot of women are at Wellesley not to drop out of school.
What, that she chose motherhood? You mean?
Yes. And she came, and she was great. And I thought there's a small-mindedness among some of these kids that kind of bothers me because it's not a grand view.
So let's go back to David Foster Wallace or J.R. Rowling, who was the commencement speaker several years ago at Harvard, and I think has wrote a brilliant commencement speech. You can Google that, short and very powerful. And she has two kind of stories to tell. One of them is about failure. That's very popular on the commencement circuit. But the other one is about a lack of imagination. And she and Wallace are saying exactly what you're saying, Marjorie. They're saying, come on, let's cultivate some open-mindedness. Let's walk around to the back of the statue. So, just because Barbara Bush didn't choose a paying career, she certainly chose to work if she was a mother, by
exactly.
God, doesn't
of
mean
many
she,
children.
And just because Christine Lagarde, is in charge of a large NGO in which she's trying to actually turn that battleship, doesn't mean she has something, doesn't have anything worthy to offer to those graduates. So it is about open-mindedness, and it is about Wallace. We default too quickly to our settings.
Very good.
One woman who never defaults to her settings, Nancy Kane. Great to see you. Thanks,
okay.
Nancy.
A pleasure.
Nancy, it is so much fun to talk to you. Nancy Kane joins us every Tuesday. We're so happy you do for Open Mic. She's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Up next, we're going to look at the Jared Remy case again and ask you whether the sins of the son should be visited on the father, whether Jared Remy's history and now his guilty plea should be held against his father, former Red Sox player and now Red Sox broadcaster, Jerry Remy. That discussion next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. Mm-hmm.
Every year, the WGBH Spring Auction is your chance to land some hot deals, and every winning bid supports the programs you love. Special thanks to Rhodes Scholar, this year's premier sponsor. Place your bids online at auction.wgbh.org.
Today at WGBHnews.org, stream WGBH TV's daily news show, Greater Boston. Meet the people and hear about the issues that define who we are. Available at WGBHnews.org right now.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you and the Museum of Science, where you can step inside the Hall of Human Life and exhibit you and discover how everyday human behavior affects our brains, our bodies, and the world around us. Details at mos.org/exhibit you. And Mass Eye and Ear, sense life, experience life. When ear, nose, and throat problems affect the way you experience life, experience the difference Mass Eye and Ear can make. Visit masseyeandear.org for more information.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And we're opening up the lines now to ask, should the sins of Jared Remy, who pled guilty to first-degree murder this morning and the death of Jennifer Martel, should those sins be visited on his father, Jerry Remy? As you know, the father is the famous broadcaster for the Red Sox. And before that, he played for the team. And minutes ago, one of our colleagues called Nesson to confirm that a day after his son pled guilty to first-degree murder, Jerry Remy will return to the Red Sox broadcasting booth tomorrow. Should Jerry Remy have stepped down from the booth? Should he at least postpone his return? Or is it unfair for him to pay any price for crime committed by his son? Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. I have to say, I am shocked. We got a press release from Nesson saying he'd be back tomorrow. Right. Nesson broadcast the Red Sox games. I was so shocked that it said he'd be back tomorrow that we asked Amanda, our colleague, to call Nesson, because I said it can't be true, even if he has decided not to step down permanently, which of course is his right, assuming that the owner of the of Nesson is happy, the Red Sox are happy with him or content with him coming back. Would you have ever believed a day after his son pleads guilty to first-degree murder that he'd return to work in the broadcast booth for a game?
Well, I, again, you know, I'm not, as I say all the time, a big, huge sports fan, but I know enough about Jerry Remy's deal that he's kind of a happy-go-lucky in the broadcast booth, making jokes about things, kidding
Don Arcillo about
you know, what they're wearing and their ties. And so it's a very lighthearted kind of thing. I mean, it might have taken a week off. I mean, that wouldn't be too much, would it, to take a week off before he goes back to the broadcast booth? I think it's asking a lot of people, especially since domestic violence is so common. It's asking a lot of people, even though he didn't do anything. It was his son that did something. Well, I would argue that he did do something. He should have done more for his son. But you've essentially written
it was an enabler of the family.
Well, I do think he was an enabler, because this was a long time coming that Jared Remy, before he killed Jennifer Martel, had abused four other women severely, had been in court 18 or 19 times, and never, except for a brief period where he was incarcerated for a couple of months, I think
81
it was,
days.
Spent no time in jail. So, yeah, I think they had which they're entitled to do, get him a very good lawyer and get him off.
877-301-8970. Are you comfortable with his father returning to work tomorrow? Obviously, he is. Obviously, his employers. We mentioned this earlier, and I think we should do this in the spirit of full disclosure. I know you would have done it in a minute had I not. Not only did Marjorie Egan receive a rather vicious letter from Jared Remy from jail, basically saying, how dare you attack my parents? Is that a fair description? And
yes,
that you blanked your way to the top journalism?
Well, that part was significant, because it was a very anti-woman thing to say that, you know, I only got my job because I slept with every single secretary boss I had since I was 21 years old.
He didn't use those words,
but he was talking about graphic, rather vulgar things I did to get to my job, which I thought, well, this shows his attitude toward a woman. So it was a vicious letter.
And we should also say, so that we're in the spirit of full disclosure, I will do it for Marjorie, is that when the father was on WEI radio several months ago, while he didn't mention Marjorie by name, he did reference her column. It was the only case, he thought, he basically said, you know, criticism is fair. The only criticism he singled out as, quote, disgusting, was Marjorie's column about the fact that they were seeking custody of their granddaughter, Jared Remy, and Jennifer Martel's child. So there's some context in which you have to put this. Before we take your calls, it's worth hearing what Remy himself, Jared Remy, had to say, a statement urging the public, this is in the courthouse today, to blame him, not his family, for what happened. Listen.
Mr. Remy, did you hear and understand the facts that...
We'll get to that in a couple of seconds. 877,
like
here it is.
Blame me for this, not my family. They thought of Jen as their fourth kid. She was a great sister to my brother and a great sister to my sister and a real mother to my son and a great mother to our little girl. My family did everything they could to help Jen and hope she had a good life. Jen always said that my family was her real family. They both loved each other, and I'm the bad apple. And if you ask my family, they'd rather have me dead than her.
They'd rather have me dead than her. When you hear someone's voice, which I hadn't heard before, it makes it even more chilling in certain ways because it humanizes someone who's done a dehumanizing act.
One last thing I just want to add before we get to the calls is that two things is that there are two other Remy children who have both had run-ins with the law involving fairly violent acts. The daughter had to be pepper sprayed by police, and the son who was rejected by a woman at a bar apparently followed her home and assaulted her. So there were three children with histories not as bad as Jared's. And we've been talking a lot about double standards involving women today. You know, imagine for a second if the broadcaster for the Red Sox were not Jerry Remy, but Phoebe Remy, his wife. Mm-hmm. If it were the mother.
She'd be gone in 30 seconds.
If it were the mother that had been on the road while she had not one, not two, but three children in trouble with the law, what our attitudes would be toward that woman going back to her job. And what we would say is that mother should have been home taking care of her children. But it's interesting we don't say that about the father.
877-301-8970. Jerry Remy, according to Nesson, will be back in the Red Sox broadcasting booth tomorrow. Should he be back there at any point? Should any of this be visited on the father? Let's take some calls. Damon, you're on the road. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for your call. Hi.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. I'm calling as both a marriage and family therapist and as a father. Mm-hmm. And I find it hypocritical that particularly you, Marjorie, are so down on Jerry for the acts of his son. His son is an adult, and his son is totally responsible for what he has done. And granted, Jerry and his wife provided legal support to him and tried, I think, on several occasions to get mental health care for this kid who's now an adult. And I think it's just impossible for any of us to put ourselves in that position and to know what we would do and what's right and what's wrong. I think also, too, Jerry Remy has had some very difficult personal experiences himself. And, you know, and again, I just it feels cruel to be so harsh with him.
Well, let me defend myself a little bit here. Is it Damien?
Damon.
And say... Jerry Remy's wife, Phoebe, watched her son beat up a woman in the driveway with a baby in her hands. I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy. But I think at that point, I would say it is time for us to stop helping our son avoid responsibility. And I think you could argue that when he started these things at 15, 16, and 17, before he was an adult, and they kept happening, I don't think you're helping your child by allowing him to evade responsibility. And that's why I blame the parents.
Well, I think you're right. And on the other hand, I don't believe that the Remy's helped him evade responsibility. I feel like the judicial system is a mess. I feel like the whole mental health system is a mess. And, you know, so there are many characters or many parts of our society to blame, but mostly it's Jared Remy. And he's a despicable human being.
By the way, Damon, let's not speak for Marjorie. Let's speak for everybody. No one thinks that the prime actor is not Jared Remy. No one is suggesting that Jerry Remy committed the deed. But I should say, as a former practicing lawyer myself, if you're paying for the lawyer and you're instructing the lawyer, I assume the bottom line in these cases should not have been get my kid off. The choice is get my kids sentenced, and I use the term not as a term of art, to some mental health facility, or don't get him off to protect the world from him and to protect him from himself. And by the way, I, as a parent, understand the impulse just like you do, and I'm glad you identified yourself as a therapist and a parent. Of course you want what's best for your kid, but there's a point at which you have to decide what's best for your kid is not freedom. But Damon, thank you very much for your call. Let me just also say one last thing about this. Even if people totally disagree with you and think there was no enabling going here at all,
yep.
I think it's a matter of sensitivity to the fact that now it's final. Now that there is someone found guilty by reason of a plea to the vicious murder of this woman in front of their four-year-old child, returning to public work tomorrow is, to me, staggering. It is absolutely staggering.
And one last thing we should say about the lawyer for Jad Remy. He talked in the piece in the Globe about how he understood.
Not the current lawyer, Ed Ryan.
No,
the lawyer that represented him all
lawyer.
The prior.
Either he talked about it or someone, a surrogate talked about it, how he knew the system really, really well and you know, knew where to go, which courts to go to, what judges to go to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Let's go to Bryce in Cambridge. Hi, Bryce.
Hey, Bryce.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Hi. I'm calling because I just wanted to talk about Jerry Remy and him coming back to work. And I think that it sounds an awfully like Albert Camus' The Plague, in that we are really blaming someone for how they are grieving. And I think it's very difficult to get into the mind of Jerry Remy and criticize him for his manner of grieving. And I think that's exactly probably what he's doing. And I think that at this point, not only are we criticizing him for enabling and what he's done in the past, but now that he is trying to just really move on, and now he recognizes that he no longer wants to be really blamed for what his son has done, I think he's trying to move on, and I think that is the way that he's going about doing it.
But Bryce, don't you think as an adult he has an obligation, since he is returning, his grieving, to use your terminology, is being done in an entertainment forum. And it seems to me that, well, of course, anyone is entitled to grieve any way they want. When you're not a shipyard worker, but you're a broadcaster for a very popular baseball team, it seems to me that there is at minimum a civil time for you to to not visit yourself on the public. And I know that people can turn off the television. I know they can turn on the radio or do some other way to listen or watch the game. But that's my concern. It's not about his freedom to grieve. You're suggesting he wants to grieve by doing what he's comfortable doing. But I think he has to think about the statement that makes about both the crime, his son, and the viewing public.
I think that's just it, though, that we as a society have determined that, say, a week is an appropriate time to be off the air.
Oh, I don't know what's appropriate. You're right. I mean, I have no idea what's appropriate. I guess I know what's inappropriate, and I think tomorrow, the day after the plea, qualifies for that. Bryce,
you know,
thanks for the call.
Again, it's different than if one of his children were run over by a truck or something. This is not, it's not exactly that. And it's also, you know, you have to think about a little bit, what is this good for the Red Sox? Is this good for Nesson?
Well, that's obviously they've decided that it's okay.
I don't know that they've decided it's okay at all. I think that it's a very difficult thing to push him out of a job in this situation. I don't know that I would imagine.
That the Red Sox hierarchy, whether it's, I don't know who runs Nesson. It's not, I mean, John Henry's not a former operator of Nesson.
Do I think they'd
like
him to go?
You don't think if they called Remy in and said, you're out of here or you're taking an extended vacation, you think Remy would say, oh, no, I'm going to be on the air. You have to fire me?
I think it's a very delicate situation. Do I think that there are people at Nesson that would like him to leave? I absolutely do. Yeah. I think it could hurt their ratings.
Sheila,
and that's what it's all about. Sheila from Norton. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, Sheila.
Hi, Marjorie. I've agreed with you all along. And a couple of things. One, it seems he has taken a shot at the other parents in his statement that he said that his parents were more parents to her than they were. So I think his parting shot has been to the parents of the deceased. But also, I think I never got the sense, and perhaps you didn't either, Marjorie, that the parents of Jared were beleaguered with him, that they continued to try to help him, and they exhausted all remedies throughout his life of bullying, etc. I feel that they covered it, and I also think even from the Globe article, we have the evidence that they tried to pay off people who had their tires slashed and things along the way. And I think that's what the problem is here,
that there's not like two people who unwittingly are at the mercy of a son who just does what he wants. They seemed a bit complicit. And I would say that who among us, to quote John Kerry, would think that they didn't talk to him and talk to her, excuse me, and say, don't go in the next day. I know they deny it, but I find that really, really hard to believe.
And by the way, just so people know what Sheila's talking about, the contention was made, I think, by Christina Hill, if I'm not wrong, her best friend and next door neighbor who's going to be with me on TV tonight, that who attempted to pull, one of the two people attempted to pull Remy off Jennifer Martell, that she had received a text saying, don't go to court, we're going to deal with this thing, but there's no evidence that happened. You know, Sheila, I'm embarrassed to say you listened to that bite much more carefully than we did. His line was, this is Jared Remy's statement, Jen always said my family was her real family. And you're right, that is intentionally or otherwise a shot at the Martell. Sheila, thank you for your call. We appreciate it.
Let's go to Sue and Natick. Hi, Sue.
Hello, Sue.
Oh, excuse me.
Hi.
I just have a couple points. Usually, you know, I totally am on the same page with you guys. Marjorie, I get it. I'm a feminist. I completely get it. However, if we put everyone in jail who had a murderer in their family or who was sort of responsible in one way or another for a murderer, think of the people, you know, Woody Harrelson, didn't his father murder someone? Gary Gilmore, his brother writes for Rolling Stone. You can't legally tar and feather. I'm not a lawyer.
Who's talking, Sue, nobody, who's talking about sending Jerry Remy to jail?
Yeah.
We're saying take a couple of days
and
off.
I think you're comparing Sue apples to oranges. I mean, this didn't you hear what Sheila just talked about, the long history here?
If Nathan takes him off the air, you know, based on their moral high ground, I'm just not sure it's doable. And the second thing is, you know, there is no owner's manual, you know, that's for being a parent, let alone a parent of a clearly mentally ill guy. I agree there is a pattern of, and it's egregious. I completely agree. But if I try walking a mile in his shoes, I can't even begin to do it. And the system, you know, we've got the cops doing the work of the mental health professionals. I mean, there are just a host of things that conspire to help the whole situation.
By the way, that also, that cops doing the job of mental health professionals applies totally to Elliot Rodger on the West Coast when they went to his apartment in April. Same sort of situation. Sue, thank you for the call. By the way, let me be clear where I am on this. I mean, I've gone back and forth about whether or not he should do this for a living. I'm now focused on tomorrow and the inappropriateness of the father returning to work in the describing a baseball game, a meaningless baseball game tomorrow with his partner. And maybe that is a place that gives him a comfort zone. But Jerry, I've never met Jerry. I mean, I hear he's a really smart guy, people have described him very positively as a very decent guy.
Yes.
And you've got to say, is this appropriately respectful of a woman who was brutally murdered and your son yesterday formally admitted that he did it? So even if you agree with Sue's analysis out there, I don't mean this to criticize you, Sue, but even if people agree in general with Sue and some of these other callers, the question is there a space in time to give people an opportunity to breathe and mourn the final outcome of this case? Sue, thanks for the call.
Joyce from Waltham. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, Marjorie. Hi, Jim.
Hey.
I actually was going to completely support you, Marjorie. Feel very strongly about this. First of all, I'm a psychologist, and the family therapist who called in was all wet, would never send him a client. One. It was ludicrous. It was to me, it was appalling. The person who just called in and said, clearly Jared is mentally ill, I'd like her to come up with a diagnosis because he has none. That's number two. You are 1,000% right. This kind of thing absolutely should not go on. And his father, as you I'm sure know, Marjorie, was still paying for his defense for murder. And if that's the ethical standard for the Boston Red Sox, as far as I'm concerned, then it's an unacceptably low standard. And I have not watched Jerry Remy all season. And as I said, I'm a huge Red Sox fan and also have been a Remy fan. So what can I say?
That was beautifully said, Joyce. Thank you very much for the call.
But you believe the Red Sox do want him out and that Remy is the obstacle. And, you know, I said
I don't know.
Before,
I have no inside information,
maybe
I just think I have heard from too many people who say it's difficult for them to watch the Red Sox broadcast with Jerry Remy there. And a lot of them are women who have had these experiences in their lives and know people who have. And I've even heard from people that said they don't want to go to his restaurant anymore. anymore. So I don't know if they really want him out. But I think, you know, in the cold light of day, it's all about the ratings. And if the ratings suffer, it may be a difficult situation for them. Okay, we are moving on from this now. We're going to talk up next to Ethan Gilsdorf. We're going to talk to him about this new translation of Beowulf done by J.R. Tolkien. And we're also going to talk about this new Legoland that's just opened. All about that, and all about Ethan's concern about Legos taking over the playlands of America. That's up next on 89.7 WGBH.
Hi, this is Marco Werman calling from the World Program in Boston.
Oh, hello, my friend.
Are you ready to talk about pufferfish and making deadly foods non-deadly? Take a little pull on it and tell us what you're tasting.
If I breathe, you can actually hear me nosing it, right?
That's a nose. It's the first time, I've got to say, I've heard the trumpet used as a percussion instrument. Join us on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Lesley University, where creativity empowers educators, artists, and counselors to turn their passions into their futures. Lesley University, what will you make happen? More information available at lesley.edu. And the Boston Speaker Series, presented by Lesley University, bringing diverse people to Boston. The series returns to Symphony Hall next season with Dan Rather, Madeline Albright, Ken Burns, and others. BostonSpeakerSeries.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. Again, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about Michael Jackson's posthumous album, Escape. Now, something from the literary world is presenting a similar set of questions. J.R.R. Tolkien, whose fan base may outnumber Michael Jackson's in number and fervor, probably thrilled about the recent publication of Tolkien's adaptation of the epic poem Beowulf. But does this go against the wishes and literary standards of Tolkien himself? But first, the long national nightmare is over. Legoland has opened in Somerville. You'll understand the connection. Our next guest has written about both. He's Ethan Gilsdorf. He's the author of Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks, an epic quest for reality among role players, online gamers, and other dwellers of imaginary realms. Ethan, it's great to see you again.
Great to be back.
So, Ethan, before you talk about some of your misgivings about Legos, and I am with you 100%, tell us about this new place in Somerville. What's the deal?
So these Legoland theme parks and sort of meccas are these giant places to experience Legos for mostly kids, but of course there are a lot of Lego fans who are adults. So this has opened up in Assembly Square, which is, you know, new and happening part of Somerville. And
it is.
It's going to draw a huge number of people, and it's this sort of giant – it's not exactly a theme park. It doesn't have outdoor rides, but it's got a lot of indoor attractions, and there's, you know, sort of 3D – well, actually 4D movies and rides and ways to, you know, play with – literally millions of Legos. They have a reproduction of downtown Boston with the Zakin Bridge and Fenway Park. So, you know, it's obviously going to be a huge hit. It opened up on Friday and already
sold out for the first week.
Yeah, already sold out, you know, for the first week or two. And, you know, I'll probably end up bringing my nephews there in the end. But, you know, it does raise some questions for me as a sort of middle-aged person who grew up playing Legos myself and had a slightly different experience of that toy and other toys.
Well, tell us. Tell us what your misgivings are.
Well, I think it's just a larger question that I have a lot that I guess as I become an older and grumpier old man, I wonder a little bit about to what extent these relatively innocent, fun, and to be honest, with Lego, very imaginative creativity engendering, you know, problem-solving toy has sort of become this giant behemoth of a commercial enterprise that has tie-ins to every major movie and video game franchise. And, you know, it's just sort of become this experience, this sort of amusement park experience when, you know, my experience of it was this was something I did on my own with my brother and the neighborhood boys. And we kind of came up with our cool, you know, contraptions that we built. And it was really helpful for us as a way to play. It wasn't something that we spent $500 on to buy, like, the ultimate 6,000-piece set that will create the Death Star, you know, and stick it up on our wall as a kind of a relic.
But Ethan, you know, even though I want to get to the money part of this, which is, I mean, the admission, if you're 3 years old, is $18, which to me is surreal.
Yes.
And the cost of Legos themselves. But while I have some sympathy to your concerns, there are a lot of you and your brothers. And when there are zillions of you and your brothers who had these intimate experiences with their friends, which they love, the natural consequence of that intimate experience is a lack of intimacy and zillions of people funding what becomes, as you say, a behemoth. I mean, that is what, I mean, that's the nature of popularity, isn't
Absolutely,
it?
Absolutely.
You don't own it anymore.
Yeah. And I think to say that Lego as a toy has become more popular isn't as troubling to me as it is to say that every time there is a toy that becomes popular, or anytime anything becomes popular, people who own the intellectual property of it, who have the capacity to do stuff with it, think, well, how can we turn this into a theme park? How can we turn this into a toy? How can we turn this into a movie? How can we turn this into a TV show? How can we turn this into a video game? And to me, it spoils some of that kind of, as you mentioned, intimate, you know, relationship with it. And it's not to say that this hasn't happened to a lot of things, including my beloved Lord of the Rings and Tolkien, which we'll get to. It's inevitable to a certain extent.
Well, you get a great line in your piece about this, where you talk about the Legoization of childhood. And one of the things I took away from your piece was too that you know, you had a bunch of Legos. My kids all had Legos, and they, you know, they were in a big box and they made things on the floor. But now there's all the sort of Lego little ideal models. You know, you go to the toy store and you've already got these creations, you know, and you're supposed to, it's less imaginative, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
I think to a certain extent, yeah. I mean, and you know, the other criticism that's been levied against Lego is charges of sexism in the way in which the toys, which have traditionally always appealed to boys, and there was something like 80%, Lego themselves did a survey some years ago and discovered that, not to their surprise, something like 80% of their users were little boys, not girls, so they thought there's got to be a way we can tap into this and make girls more interested in our product. And their response to it was to kind of Barbie-fy Legos, you know, which actually was very successful for them. And they it's, you know, this Lego Friends line is, you know, pastel-colored, you know, beauty parlors and ice cream shops and, you know, dog walking services. You know, the little girl toys don't get to go on cool adventures and save the world and swim with sharks and fight in whatever spaceships. I mean, you can, of course. The way I remember Lego was always inevitably there was a certain point where you had your set and you're like, you know, are we going to mix these with everything else? All right, let's do it. And then you can have like some weird, you know, Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, you know, fire truck mashup, you know, that's this sort of weird hybrid thing. And that's where I think the kids are kind of taking it back. And they're like, you know, we're going to do with this as we want to.
We're talking to Ethan Gilsdorf. And while you're talking about your own personal experiences, you and your brother, and now would you say your nieces, nephews, whomever you're contemplating taking, you know, my thing was, Marjorie,
what
is my kid? One of my kids was obsessed with Legos. And you know what the problem is? Because your kids have no comprehension of price.
Oh,
they
so
want
expensive.
Their best friends to have what they have.
Yeah.
So when a little kid who they barely knew had a birthday party to which they were invited, you'd take them to the toy store. They'd point to the thing that they want, the Lego thing, which is exactly like theirs, in a box the size of a matchbox for $57.
Oh, yeah. They were so expensive.
Plastic.
And you feel like a real cheapskate if you just got like one little Lego figure
right.
for $12.
Exactly.
You showed up with a $12 thing, a little bit embarrassed about the whole thing.
But having said all this and your concern, I think the vast majority of which are legit, this is going to be huge in some.
Absolutely.
The first week is not aberrational. This is going to be a monster.
And it's the only one in New England. There's only, you know, a dozen of these in North America. The nearest one is New York City and Toronto. So very smartly, you know, they're calling it Legoland Boston. As someone who lives in Somerville, it's really Legoland Somerville, Somerville Pride. But, you know, it is going to be this destination. And I do wonder a little bit about, you know, is it going to cut into a little bit of the traffic that would normally be going to the Boston Children's Museum? Is it going to cut into the traffic that go to the Museum of Science? You know, I'd be curious to see if this is brings new people who've never been to the area into Boston, or whether it's going to sort of suck away some of the business from some of our landmark institutions that have been around for a long time.
See, the big dilemma for me, Ethan, is different. The question is, can I park in the middle and go to both Home Depot and Legoland at the same visit at Assembly Square? Let's move on to something else you've written about. This
sure.
in the New York Times. One would argue even bigger than Legos is J.R.R. Tolkien. And most of us know him, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. But apparently there is something, not apparently, I see you have it.
Yes.
He did a translation of Beowulf ages ago that never saw the light of day and finally is. Is this something that excites Tolkienophiles, or are they only excited, other than academics, only excited by those things that come out of his mind?
No, they're very excited about this.
Why? Because anything from Tolkien is
there's
huge.
Part of that. Anything that any scrap of paper that his eldest son, who's the surviving sort of literary executor, this older gentleman who's been gradually publishing various scraps and fragments of his father's literary legacy. So anytime there's something new, and actually this translation comes with some new work original by Tolkien, including a short story and a couple poems. So Tolkien fans will have that there, but there's enormous numbers of notes about his translation process and how he decided to make decisions about translating this old English, you know, 8th to 11th century epic into modern English and sort of what decisions get made. So it's hugely interesting to Tolkien fans. And I think to Beowulf scholars, there's some interest as well, because this guy was a master and people don't realize that he was well known for Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, but he was an old English, you know, Anglo-Saxon languages expert at Oxford University.
I didn't know that
was his
today.
That was his earlier original expertise that he did long before he started to write fantasy novels.
So I didn't realize, and I suppose I should have, that Seamus Heaney, the great Irish poet, had also translated Beowulf. So whose translation is better?
That is the question. Yes. Well, many people are wondering. Beowulf
Seamus
was the,
Heaney, yeah, I should have said.
Yeah, Beowulf was the poem that we all had to read in high school, and some of us had good translations in our Norton anthologies of literature, and others of us didn't. And I think when the Heaney came out, Heaney, by the way, former local guy who was at Harvard for many years. And taught there before his death. He really repopularized it, and he did this beautiful, some would say, took some liberties with the translation, this alliterative verse version that really tried to, in some ways, capture the flavor and the language of the original, and made it a lot more accessible with language that wasn't as old-fashioned. So people will be sort of pitting the Heaney versus the Tolkien. I have no doubt that the Tolkien will be on the bestseller list for a little while. I'm not sure if it will ever totally unseat the Heaney version.
And what's the controversy for those who have not been in the middle of this?
Well, the controversy largely has to do with whether or not, and this is something that comes up all the time with other authors, if, for example, Hemingway, his heirs, you know, maybe they need some more money to buy another, you know, house on Key West. I don't know what they do with the money, but it's probably not fair to say that. But, you know, heirs of famous people who find stuff that is valuable that they can publish. So an unfinished manuscript, an unfinished novel, and here over the years, his son Christopher, Tolkien's son Christopher, has been publishing these things that really never intended to be published. And Tolkien himself said that he had, when he'd finished this translation in 1926, he sort of did it and said, "I'm done with it." But his quote was that he was, unhappy with it. He called it, "It was hardly to my liking." So he was never satisfied with it. And he played around with possibly publishing it and revising it, but never did. And it literally sat on a shelf for 88 years. So the question is that fair to him to publish something that he wouldn't have wanted to have been read by the general public?
The answer is no. Now, we only have 2 minutes left. Can you spend half of that 2 minutes? Can you read a little piece of this to us?
Well, the thing that's interesting about the translation is it's the prose version. So the version that's published that came out last Thursday is a prose version, which means the line goes all the way to the end of the page. It doesn't look like a poem. And it sounds half like a story, half like a poem. I'll read two sections. This is from the prose translation. "Time passed on. Afloat upon the waves was the boat beneath the cliffs. Eagerly the warriors mounted the prow, and the streaming seas swirled upon the sand. Men at arms bore to the bosom of the ship their bright harness, their cunning gear of war. Then, men on a glad voyage, thrust her forth with her well-joined timbers." So the poem is about, you know, there's these Scandinavians and they're going off to war. And the story of Beowulf is that the hero comes to help out the king of the Danes who's got a monster problem. You know, Grendel shows up.
He's got a monster problem.
And Tolkien tried to do a version in verse that was going to mimic the old version, which has this very weird metrics of the way Old English prosody was done, which was this, I don't need to explain the complication of it, but it had lots of alliteration, and it was literally like, you can imagine like a drum beat or like someone banging an anvil with a warhammer or something. And the same, if we have time, I don't know if to read.
We only have about 30 seconds.
Okay, then I won't get into it, but that's a really hard thing for anyone to try to translate. This is a 3,000-word poem. So his version is an approximation that may or may not please fans of Tolkien, may or may not please fans of Beowulf.
It pleases you.
It pleases me.
How excited are you when
it
you
is
heard
exciting.
About this? When you first heard about that it was being released, look at the smile.
Yeah.
How did you feel about
very
this?
Very excited. Very excited. And for fans, they want to mine it for evidence of sort of how this influenced his work. So any fan of Lord of the Rings is going to want to read this to see that scene of the thief going into the dragon's hoard and stealing the cup. You know, this is the sort of wellspring from which all of Tolkien's work came.
Ethan
well,
Gilsdorf.
It was great
Thank
to talk
you.
To you, Ethan Gilsdorf. So, writer and author of Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks, an epic quest for reality among role players, online gamers, and other dwellers of imaginary realms. Thanks again for coming in on both of these, Legoland and Beowulf. And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for an interview with filmmaker Errol Morris, on his latest documentary on Donald Rumsfeld. We also check in with the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy. Browdy. I
just want to thank our
I
production team here, Chelsea Murs, Will Roseup, Amanda McGowan, Devin Karambelis, and John Parker is our engineer. Thanks again for listening. See you again tomorrow.